I work with the Christian Medical Fellowship, which is a group of 5,000 doctors and 1,000 medical students, and now about 400 nurses as well throughout the UK and Ireland. We're all Bible-believing Christians, and most of us work in the NHS. And as Andrew says, my background is in general surgery, and if you're wondering about my accent, I come originally from New Zealand, so that explains it. There is no one more vulnerable, more innocent, and killed in greater numbers than the unborn child. That is an absolute foundational fact. And there is no one with less legal protection in the world. And that's not that there aren't a huge number of other incredibly important social justice issues, but that should put it into context for you. And we see this in the media. Now, I'm a great animal lover, and this is the story of Cecil the lion that you may remember, and the American dentist who made the mistake of shooting Cecil the friendly lion. And of course, it was an international scandal that the life of this innocent lion was taken. And in the same way, if we look at children who are born, we see a completely different attitude from the world to that of children just a few weeks or months earlier who were still in the womb. So just a sample here, this is Chinese toddler left for dead in hit and run crash, dies, a little two-year-old knocked over in China. Why is that major world news? It's a tragedy, but contrast it. Child sacrifice in Uganda, huge scandal. Teenage boyfriend Brian Woodbridge's punch killed unborn boy. Big story. Now, why is that? Well, it's because that little boy was wanted. That's why that's huge news. Whereas other children the same age who aren't wanted, it's a completely different reaction to it. Or this one, you know, we always get these stories after major earthquakes, don't we, of those who've survived the longest and been pulled out alive. And this was the little two-week-old girl found alive in the rubble, and what an extraordinary international celebration that was. And yet for babies just a few weeks younger, it's a completely different story altogether. So just a flash of some of the things that are happening. Four terminations before I was 16, a young British lady. Of course, there are people in Britain who've had up to 8 terminations, abortions, so it's really just being treated as a form of birth control. Women considering abortion should get independent counselling, say doctors. Well, we would say that's a good idea, but Parliament blocked that idea and would not enable women to have independent counselling just a few years ago. Abortion clinic inspections find 14 broke the rules. Now, in order to have an abortion in Britain, you've got to see 2 doctors, you've got to fulfil a number of criteria, you have to have a form filled out, and then the abortion can take place under the Abortion Act. But they found a few years ago that, and you can see the date here, this is 2012, that they found a whole lot of abortion clinics that carried out the abortions without the forms being filled out at all. That's against the law. It's actually perjury, but there've never been any prosecutions or convictions, because the reality is that the police don't investigate, the Crown Prosecution Service doesn't prosecute, the Parliament turns a blind eye, judges don't bring convictions. In the third world, unwanted babies disappear, and it's called gendercide. It's happening in this country too. And this was a story that The Independent did a lot more investigation in, and they estimated that UK ethnic groups avoid daughters through selective abortion, even though it's illegal here, somewhere, certainly a few thousand per year. On the slightly more gruesome side, aborted babies incinerated to heat UK hospitals. Well, this was Addensbrook, which is the main hospital in Cambridge, so the other place from Oxford, if you like. And it's just another indication of the value which is given to unborn human life, that after abortion, the fetal remains were just treated as rubbish and put through the hospital incinerators rather than any recognition. So this is stuff happening here. New undercover video exposes unsanitary bacteria-filled conditions at Planned Parenthood clinics, while Tissue Firm boss reveals they need 50 livers a week to keep up with demand. Now, Planned Parenthood is the major organisation in the US which is doing abortions, and an organ trafficking scheme was uncovered, but again, no convictions for this. So they were aborting the babies and then selling the tissue commercially. And in fact, instead in Britain, what we've got at the moment is a push for the complete decriminalisation of abortion altogether, right up at the very least to the age of viability, which is 24 weeks, but probably beyond that. And we're expecting in the next few months there will be an attempt to amend a domestic abuse bill by completely decriminalising abortion. Now, that has already happened in the state of Victoria in Australia, and in Canada as well. Of course, the result of that is that you get more and more late abortions, you lose any statistics, and you lose any possibility of doing investigations. And we are, believe me, right on the brink of doing this in Britain at the moment in the next few months. Current pressures from public policy point of view. After Ireland says yes to abortion, what next for Northern Ireland? So the Irish government has just made the decision to legalise, and there's huge pressure on Northern Ireland, which is the only place in the UK now where there are restrictive laws, to change the law as well. Isle of Man abortion law change could be weeks away. It just needs a final signature. It is now inevitable, and that's the most liberal law in Britain, which will be abortion on demand up to 14 weeks and for medical grounds, which includes mental health beyond that. This was just unstoppable. Just a few weeks ago, abortion at home legalised after government bows to pressure from campaigners. So this was the new health minister, Matt Hancock, who with a stroke of a pen has legalised medical abortion, so that's chemical abortion through taking tablets at home in Britain. So you had to go to a health institution. Now both tablets can be taken at home. That means that the woman aborts down the toilet and she flushes away the remains. So that's now legal in Britain. That's just happened. And then if you want to protest, well, your right to do that is now at great risk. Abortion clinic buffer zone announcement expected next month. So this was August. So sometime this month, we're expecting a decision from the government about this issue. So these are people who stand outside abortion clinics to pray, to counsel people who are coming. Now we're creating these buffer zones all over the UK, so it's no longer probably going to be possible to do that. So there you are. There's an introduction to the stuff that's happening around the world and elsewhere. So let's focus more on the facts now and think about numbers and reasons. So in the UK, the law allows abortion of healthy babies up to 14 weeks and disabled babies up to term, and there are a number of conditions which have to be fulfilled. We've seen 9 million abortions so far in Britain since the Abortion Act came in 1967. So that's 200,000 a year if we include Scotland as well as England and Wales. And put that up against the number of adoptions of babies. This is babies younger than 1 year of age. There were 88 in the last 12-month period. 88 baby adoptions. That's dropped from many thousands back in the 1960s. So that's one baby adoption for every 2,000 plus abortions in Britain. It's just how the numbers have gone up. So you see there's a quick rise after legalisation in 67 up to the current plateau now at just below 200,000. So 9 million, yeah.
Will you be making the PowerPoint available?
Yeah.
Thank you.
for a very stiff charge. It will be available. So, you know, 9 million, what does 9 million actually mean? Well, I think the best way of thinking of it is comparing it with other numbers. So that's 15% of the entire British population of 60 million. Or it's more than the combined populations of all those cities. Now, those are all Britain's biggest cities with the exception of London. Or five times the UK casualties in both World Wars, World War I and II. So these are absolutely massive numbers that we are talking about. And as we'll see later, it's had a huge impact on the demography of Britain, in that there are, you know, if you start in 67, well, that's only 50 years ago, isn't it? So all of these people, had they been born, would still be alive, and they would be in the 0 to 50 age group. So, and that's just Britain. So, more specifically, 600 every day. That includes 3,000 a year after 20 weeks. That's halfway through pregnancy. Including 18,000 with special needs, with disabilities of various kinds. And 98% of abortions are technically illegal. Now, I'll come back to why that is very, very shortly. But if we focus more broadly than the UK, what's happening worldwide, the figure that's generally accepted, although some dispute it, is 43 million abortions every year throughout the world. Now, when we consider that there are 57 million deaths in the world every year from all other causes, now add those numbers together, that's 100 million. So more than 4 out of 10 human deaths is a child in the womb being killed by a nurse or a doctor. Okay? So put that up against the total number of casualties in World War II, and there's a push for more and more extension into countries where it is still illegal. Now, that only bothers you if you think that human life before birth is human life, worthy of respect. If you don't believe that, if you're the kind of person, as most people are, who gets really upset about Cecil the Lion, or, you know, child sacrifice in Uganda, and so on, but is unmoved by this, then that won't bother you. And it doesn't bother most politicians, and sadly, it doesn't bother most people in British churches either. So when we look at the world map, this is the picture. So if it's green or blue, it's either illegal or restricted. And the countries where it's red or dark red is in China, is where the laws are much more restrictive. And what we're also seeing is sex-selective abortion, particularly in the countries in South Asia, India, China, and in Southeast Asia. So these are the sex ratios at birth. They haven't changed in the last few years. And the tall ones, 112 males to every 100 females, those countries are Vietnam, China, and India, whereas the world average is on the left-hand side there, so just over 106. So, you know, male babies are born in higher percentages anyway, naturally, for a variety of reasons. But in certain countries, sex selection abortion operates, and it's virtually always girls who pay for it. And so here, the figure is, you know, 160 million missing women currently in China and India. And this is mixed in with other issues, because when there aren't enough women, that also fuels prostitution, human trafficking, and all of that. Now, you're not told about the link, but it is a very real causal link there. Russia tightened its laws because they were aborting more abortions than live births at one point, and Putin felt that this was not good for the demography, so for purely practical reasons, pragmatic reasons, he restricted the abortion laws a few years ago. And so the abortion rate in Russia and China has actually dropped. But this is the world map here, and this is for legal abortion, so the numbers are lower. But the big band at the top is China, and you see that peaked and it's coming down, but there's still most abortions in the world are happening in China And this is the former Soviet Union, and then Russia and the independent states. And you can see those numbers have come down quite dramatically as a result of policy changes. So coming back to the UK now, the timeline is basically this. We had the Offences Against the Person Act of 1861, which makes a procuring abortion on yourself a crime, and also carrying out an abortion on someone else a crime. And that law is still in place. All the Abortion Act did in 1967 was that it created a variety of circumstances in which the law of 1861 didn't apply. And what campaigners are wanting to do is basically strike out the Offences Against the Person Act altogether, and that will, or the clauses in it that relate to abortion, and what that will have the effect of doing is it will render the whole of the Abortion Act absolutely null and void, with all of its provisions about two doctors and a set of criteria and conscience and statistics and all that kind of stuff. So they want to just pull the carpet out from the whole thing. The Human Fertilisation Act changed the Abortion Act in that it lowered the upper limit from 28 weeks to 24 weeks for able-bodied babies, but it legalised it right up to the time of birth for disabled babies. Now, there are a number of grounds, but the bottom line is that 98% of all abortions in Britain are carried out under ground C, which is that the continuance, I quoted it there, the continuance of the pregnancy would involve risk greater than if the pregnancy were terminated of injury to the physical or mental health of the pregnant woman. And this is a really get-out clause because of the word mental health. And 99% of all ground C abortions are done on grounds of mental health. Now, the reason that's very interesting is because there's no evidence actually that abortion protects mental health.
Yeah.
And so there's no evidence that this clause mental health ever applies, okay, but these are the grounds on which they are carried out. So what I'm saying to you is that every day, 600 times a day in Britain, two doctors put their signature to a legal document affirming something for which there's no medical evidence. Okay? So they're technically illegal. Now that is actually perjury. And I've said this on national, I've said it on the Radio 4 Today program. I said 98%, and the presenter nearly fell off his chair. 98%? No, I've said it on BBC television. This is perjury. No one has taken issue with it. What they do is they say, well, we should change the law so that we're being honest about it. So that's what's pushing for the complete decriminalisation. So we have a law which it seems to be restrictive, but in practice we have abortion on request because doctors simply sign the mental health clause forms. So in practical terms, 95% of abortions occur between 7 weeks, which is this stage, about 3-4 weeks after the heart has started beating. This is the youngest stage at which you can have an abortion, and that's because it takes a while after the woman's missed her period to get along to the clinic and so on. So 95% occur between 7 weeks and 20 weeks, which is halfway through pregnancy. And it's just 4 weeks short of viability, because even though pregnancy lasts 40 weeks, babies now, in the best units, 80% of them will survive from 40 weeks with good neonatal care, but not many below that. So, I mean, I don't need to speak to the pictures, but 18 weeks is the stage about when most women are having their scans and the baby's hiccuping and coughing and moving around and sucking its thumb and so forth. So, and that's well within the abortion on mental health grounds request. What does the public think and MPs? Well, actually, most MPs do support a reduction in the upper limit. The difficulty is getting it to a vote in Parliament, and it is true that for late abortion there is some public anguish about it, and the reasons for that are many and varied. First of all, stories of disabled babies being aborted, who, if they were born, would survive without neonatal intensive care. So you can abort a baby right up to the moment of birth if it has a disability, and there are 100 or so every year, more than 100 in Britain, who are aborted for those reasons. So if you take Down syndrome, for example, 91% of all who are detected prenatally are aborted in Britain. In some countries, like Iceland, it's 100%. There was an inquiry that Fiona Bruce, one of the Christian MPs in Parliament, did a few years ago on this, and produced a report which nothing has yet happened in terms of a change of the law, although there is a campaign to try and change the law on abortion for disabled babies who are capable of being born alive, so beyond 24 weeks, but it has had no real support in the House of Lords where it's been introduced up until now. Another thing which makes people queasy is the story of babies surviving after abortion. So, you know, 66 babies born alive after abortion in 2005, 16 after 22 weeks, and 50 before. So these were babies who lived for between 1 and 600 minutes, so that's 10 hours after being aborted alive. Now, you may say, well, 2005, that's a long time ago. Why don't we have any figures beyond that? Well, the government, when this was in the Daily Mail, the government then decided to stop collecting these statistics. So we just don't know anymore what is happening, what the numbers are. Gianna Jessen was an American who was aborted alive and survived. Now she's a pro-life campaigner. So there you are. 3D ultrasounds where babies are seen moving in the womb and responding. When they appeared on the front of newspapers a few years ago, these sort of things make people think as well. And in many abortion clinics, if you go in and the baby is having an abortion, they're doing an ultrasound, they simply put a screen up and won't show the woman because, you know, the facts must be hidden. Now, I realise in speaking on this issue that it's incredibly difficult, and I'm not wanting to in any way undermine the fact and the reality of unplanned pregnancies and the agonies that people go through. But what I'm telling you here this morning is just the reality of what is happening, and I hope it gives some balance to what we normally get. Can babies feel pain? Well, the official view from the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists is that they can't below 26 weeks. But actually, if when you look at that, there's very little evidence on which this is based, although this is the official view and it's parroted in Parliament as well. And if you stick a needle, of course, into a looking after a neonate at 24 weeks, of course, they're going to cry. If you stick a needle in the womb, the baby will withdraw the reflex in the same way that we would, and also produce stress hormones in the same way that we could. So the point is, you know, how do you know? And a few years ago, a leading paediatric journal called the RCOG position the emperor's new clothes, because they said there was actually no evidence for it whatsoever. But this was the view that was put. And the best evidence really suggests that fetal pain is a reality from about 16 weeks or so, which is well within the limits. Survival of babies has also challenged people's views. So the fact that we're getting better and better at keeping babies alive who are born younger, and as you see in the centre one, the best centres of excellence are showing survival rates of 66 and 80% at 23 and 24 weeks. So it's just a little bit over halfway through pregnancy. And my wife is a paediatrician. When she was training in New Zealand, she did neonates, and I remember that they had a 24-weeker who survived back in the 1980s, it was. And it was a major story. It was the subject of a grand round, and all the doctors came. But it's a very common event now with improvements in neonatal care. And then we haven't got time to go into this in great detail, but there are there's stuff on our website which gives you the detail, and anyone who wants to write to me, I can send you all the peer-reviewed journals that back this up. But the big debate has been about the long-term effects of abortion on the mother, and in particular three different areas, and they're listed here on your slide. When we talk about preterm delivery, that means a woman who's had an abortion is much more likely to have a premature birth in a subsequent pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And it's dose related in the sense that the more abortions you've had, the greater the risk is. For one abortion, you're 30% higher, two, it's 60% higher, three, it's 100% higher, and so on. And this is a matter that no one disputes in the world literature. It is just a fact. But it is downplayed in Britain, and there are no British studies. It's all American and European stuff which shows this. And a very good friend of mine and a colleague have an article that they're trying to get published in the British Journal about this in Britain, but it's not yet published, and it's a very hard job. So there's an attempt to suppress the medical facts in this whole issue. But this is a matter that no one disputes now, the link between abortion and preterm delivery. And of course, that's going to have major repercussions, because babies that are born preterm and premature have many more health problems, particularly cerebral palsy and brain damage and so on. And of course, they cost the NHS a huge amount of money. But that's the kind of research that, you know, no one does, because it's politically incorrect research. With mental health, there was a major study by the British, by the Royal College of Psychiatrists back in 2011. They looked at all the studies, and they concluded that mental health risk of abortion is the same as that for childbirth. There were question marks about that, but at least what they didn't do was to confirm that the mental health risk of abortion was less than that of childbirth. And that is the what every doctor affirms when they sign the form. And it was actually on the back of this that I was in the Radio 4 studio with the president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and John Humphreys. And John asked me about this, and I said 98%, and he nearly fell off his chair, because people just aren't aware of this. Breast cancer, I think our official line at CMF is that the issue is still disputed. There have been three meta-analyses, big studies that have been done. Two of them have shown a link, one hasn't. But you can imagine there's a huge amount of political stuff in there. And if you want all the detail and the peer-reviewed references and the exact stats and stuff, we can supply those there on our website. If you simply go to the advocacy page, you can find it, or I can circulate it for you. So there we are. We looked at the world phenomenon, the law in Britain, what's changing opinion about late abortion in Britain, and then some of the health effects. And let's move back to the public policy stuff and then come back to the Bible in looking at this. There is a very strong pro-abortion coalition in Britain which has the ear of government. And when Matt Hancock recently signed the order allowing home medical abortion, it was after he had been lobbied by BPAS, the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. And it was interesting that Jeremy Hunt, who for many reasons was unpopular as a health minister, but strongly pro-life, while he was the health minister, this didn't happen. Within weeks of Matt Hancock becoming health minister, the deal was done. And of course, what that is going to do is that, the next step, of course, of having both the medical abortion pills at home and aborting down the toilet and flushing the remains away is to be able to buy it on the internet. And so that's where we're moving next with it. So this is their agenda: complete decriminalisation, nurse-led medical abortion at home. We are very worried about the conscience clause. If the law does change in the direction that it seems to be heading to, what will happen to doctors and nurses who don't want to be involved? Because currently there is a conscience clause in the Abortion Act, although it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court as being very narrow in scope and only applying to those who are actually involved directly in the process rather than the preparation and so on. But what happens in practice now is that actually most abortions completely bypass the medical profession altogether. So women are not going to their GPs, they're going to an abortion clinic, they're having a pregnancy test, they get very little in the way of counselling or consideration of options, and they go on the conveyor belt to abortion. And under some operating procedures passed by Parliament a few years ago, again, this was a health minister's signature, no doctor needs see the patient, nurses can carry out most parts of the procedure. They did affirm that pre-signing the forms before the woman had turned up or before she was even pregnant was actually illegal, but nothing has happened in terms of any prosecutions. And they said abortion on grounds of gender alone is illegal, but we know it's still happening in Britain. So the trends we're seeing, and when I was a medical student back in the 1980s, I remember going to a talk on abortion before I really became concerned about this issue, and we were told by a Canadian doctor, Philip Ney, who's been a long-time pro-life campaigner, psychiatrist, and a Christian. He said, this is what's going to happen in the future. Women will have chemical abortions at home and they'll flush the baby down the toilet. And everyone thought this is absolutely ridiculous. But this is exactly now what has happened. It was an absolutely true prophecy. And so we've moved from a situation where doctors did abortions to where nurses are doing them. From privately funded, where people had to pay, to being publicly funded. So even if they're done in private institutions like BPAS or Mary Stopes, they're paid for by the taxpayers' money almost exclusively now. From NHS to private providers, so moving out of the hospitals to BPAS and MS, from late to early, from surgical to medical, and from hospital and clinic to home. So nurse-led, publicly funded home abortions procured with chemicals rather than any surgical procedures. That's the direction, that's the trajectory we're seeing in Britain and in most Western countries. So what do medical ethics codes say? Well, very interesting, the Hippocratic Oath. Heard of that? Yeah? Hippocrates. There was a day when every doctor on graduation had to sign the Hippocratic Oath. It's no longer necessary. And the sole reason for that is abortion. That's why it's not taken anymore. Because the Hippocratic Oath forbids abortion. In like manner, I will not give a woman a pessary to reduce abortion. That's exactly what it says. I had a debate on Twitter not too long ago with the chairman of the Royal College of General Practitioners, and I said the Hippocratic Oath forbids abortion. And she says, absolute lies, Peter. So I just provided a link to the Hippocratic Oath. I mean, it's extraordinary that most doctors don't even know that, because many people read the Hippocratic Oath nowadays. And actually, after the Second World War, because of some of the things that doctors were involved in then, the Hippocratic Oath was updated in a document called the Declaration of Geneva Statement. And when that was first drafted, it said, I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception, 1948. Now, and then they changed that in 1983, and it now reads, from its beginning. And the beginning is left conveniently undefined. Now, why is that? Well, it was because there was a logical disconnect between the Hippocratic Oath and the Declaration of Geneva and what doctors were actually doing with the massive legalization of abortion worldwide, because this is a relatively recent phenomenon in world history. We're only talking about the last 50 to 100 years that this has happened. And so they had a choice, you know, do we change our practice or do we change our ethical code? Well, they just rewrote their ethical code. So what they were doing was no longer unethical. What about Christians? Well, at conferences like Keswick and Word Alive and Spring Harvest and so on, interviews. So these are keen Christians of British churches. In 2010, this study was done, and the question, or the statement, do you agree or disagree with this? Abortion can never be justified. Now, I know a lot of people agonise over hard cases. I'm going to come back to that in the time we've got left. But look at these figures. 28% disagree a little, 17% disagree a lot. So 45% of the keenest Christians. Why is this? Well, I think my theory is that because this issue is very seldom ever preached on in churches. When did you last hear a sermon on it? Mm. Does the Bible have anything to say about it? Well, if you go to the Bible and look up abortion in a concordance, if you're as old as Andrea and me, or on Bible Gateway, if you're a millennial or iGen member, then you won't find the word abortion. So does that mean the Bible doesn't have anything to say on abortion? Well, no. There's a lot about infanticide. There's a lot about child sacrifice. They didn't have the technology we had. And it's interesting that the early church was very strongly opposed to it as well. Right back in the first century we're talking about. So why was that? It was on the basis of principles in Scripture. So the first principle here is that, you know, we must not discriminate against any human beings on the basis of biological characteristics. You know, we think racism is desperately wrong, sexism is desperately wrong, and we shouldn't discriminate. Ageism is wrong. Well, ageism works at both ends. We shouldn't do to a human being at any age what we wouldn't do to those at other ages. The emphasis in Scripture, the protection of those who are vulnerable, so those categories of the poor, the alien, widows, orphans, and so on. A bias in Scripture towards those who can be exploited. Well, who is more vulnerable and innocent, I ask. And plenty of references to life before birth. I've listed some of them there. You can get the slide afterwards, or they're all in the abortion handout we've got here that you can take as well. Not quite enough for everybody. But lots of references in the Old and New Testament, and over 60 references to the event of conception. And in fact, the best known is Psalm 139, where David is looking back at his prenatal life and he's saying, "You knit me together in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. Your eyes saw my unformed body." And what David is doing here is that he is affirming, first of all, God's communion with the unborn child. Even before David was aware he existed, God nonetheless had a relationship with him of grace. It was a relationship of grace that did not depend upon his neurological capacity. And he's affirming also the continuity of life before birth and after birth. He's saying that was me back there. I'm just reading through Jeremiah at the moment. It's quite depressing, the last chapters of Jeremiah, because you know, the prophet gives all his messages and no one listens, and then they just carry on doing stuff anyway. But so we all know about the fall of Jerusalem and the fact that the Israelites were taken off, the Jews were taken off into captivity in Babylon for many years, 70 years before they came back and rebuilt the temple and, you know, and paved the way for the coming of the Lord Jesus. But very few Christians are aware of what the sins were that led to the fall of Jerusalem. But it's all there in the Scriptures. If you go back to Kings and Chronicles, it was Manasseh, the king, shed so much innocent blood that he filled Jerusalem from end to end. These things happened, 2 Kings 24, because of the sins of Manasseh and all the shedding of innocent blood, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord was not willing to forgive. So it was actually, it was the shedding of innocent blood primarily by the Jewish people that led to the exile in Babylon. If we look at the life of Jesus, we know that Jesus, the natural reading of the Gospels is that the life of Jesus began at conception when the angel visited, and that it began in a moment of time. John 1:14, the word became flesh, and the form of the verb there used in Greek is the aorist tense, which talks about an event which happened in a moment of time in the past, not a process. And we know that he was made in all ways like us. He had to be in order to be the perfect sacrifice for us, fully human and fully God. So that implies that we were also made like him in our human life. Interesting that he escaped being killed as a baby, like Moses did, taken to Egypt. And he was, of course, our atonement. What God has joined together, let no man separate. We might think that talks about marriage, and of course it does, but actually it also prefigures the coming together of the male and female gametes, egg and sperm, in order to form. What God has joined together, let no man separate. And I love the story in John 8 of the woman caught in adultery, and of course, you know, we know that she was caught in the act, that adultery was against the law, that it was a capital offence under Old Testament law, and that because she was caught in the act, then the man must have been there. Yeah, because she was caught in the act. So he must have been there. But only the woman was brought, so it was the hypocrisy, and it was of the people who wanted to stone her to death. And of course, abortion is in many ways the story of the absent male, because every baby has a father. Yeah. And we know that the main thing determining whether a woman has an abortion or not is how supportive her partner is. Yeah. That's well developed in research. So these are, you know, babies who've been abandoned by the one who should be speaking for them and advocating for them. It is in large part a male problem, actually. And there's some very interesting research that's just come out of Hungary in the last few months or so. And Hungary is seeing a huge dramatic drop in the number of abortions. And a lot of this is linked to social policy, which Hungary is bringing in to to promote marriage, to provide support for women, and those kind of social measures are what are leading women voluntarily to be less likely to have abortions. So Jesus, of course, was the only innocent one there. He could have thrown the first stone. He didn't. He said, "Neither do I condemn you." He granted forgiveness to the woman, and what do you say to her? Go and sin no more. And it's what we call the middle way. What do you do with a situation of unplanned pregnancy? Do you adopt for abortion, or do you leave the woman with the burden of looking after a baby which she perhaps never planned and doesn't have the means to care for? And the Christian way, I think, is the middle way. It's the way of no condemnation, but grace and help and assistance, whether it's emotional, physical, financial, or whatever, to offer to people. And Christians have been pioneers in the whole area of crisis pregnancy care, where they're offering alternatives to women who find themselves with crisis pregnancies. So just in closing, just look at a few of the really difficult questions. And the reason I spend a bit of time on this is because my experience with medical students and doctors is that they avoid getting into any discussion about abortion because they're afraid of getting the difficult questions that they can't answer. Mm. Okay? It's a bit like, as Christians, you know, doing evangelism. Why do we refrain from sharing our faith? Well, you know, part of the reason we're afraid people might ask us questions we don't know the answers to. And so that renders us completely silent and not being effective witnesses. And you find the same thing here. And if you're wanting to be really serious about this issue, and as I've argued to you already, there's no one more innocent and more vulnerable and killed in greater numbers than the unborn child. So it has to be up there as one of the most important, if not the most important, human rights issue on the planet for human beings today and for Christians. If you want to be serious about this, then you really have to do the work to know the answers to the difficult questions. Because if you don't, you will be rendered silent. And the greatest sin of the church, I think, in this whole area, is actually the sin of silence. Yeah. It's the unwillingness of preachers to preach. It's the unwillingness of people to speak out. The unwillingness, even, sadly, of Christian doctors and medical students to put their heads above the parapet because it's so politically incorrect and unpopular. But we have to have the courage to do it. And we have to be advocates. We have to be a voice for those who have no voice. And we have to provide the compassionate alternatives to abortion. So you've got to be able to handle the difficult questions. And of course, one of the first ones you always get is, well, you know, thousands and thousands of women died from terrible backstreet abortions, and this is why we legalized abortion in the first place. Well, actually, it's absolute nonsense. This is a map of the maternal mortality by cause going back to the 1930s, and you can see a lot more women did die in pregnancy in the 1930s, but it was still only 400 deaths per 100,000, and abortion and miscarriage, so both of them, both abortion and miscarriage, is the orange one at the top. Now you see that by the time abortion was legalised in 1967 here, we were down to less than 20 deaths in the whole of the UK, maternal deaths, and since then we're down to very small single figures. I mean, the fact is that people just do not die even of backstreet abortions with modern treatments and antibiotics. In fact, in Britain, that's the percentage, 0.013% of abortions that are performed under the grounds to save the life of the mother. So it's just such tiny print. 1 in 50,000 pregnancies, we're saying. Most gynecologists, obstetricians, are never going to see one in their lifetime. That's how rare it is. So don't be misled by the case of the Irish case of Savita, for example, where there was a lot of distortion of the clinical facts. I don't believe that she died because she was denied an abortion at all. What about in the situation where you have to, whether continued sort of pregnancy really does risk the life of the mother? Well, then the question is, it's a choice between, do you stand by and watch two people die, because if the mother dies, the baby's going to die anyway, or do you intervene to save the only one who you can, which is the mother in that situation? And what happens in those situations is the, you know, the pregnancy is ended, it's usually in the second trimester, and that's a choice that, as I say, is incredibly rare, but doctors would say that that's the only justifiable case to save the life of the mother, and it's simply because either both are going to die or you can save one. Fetal handicap, we're only talking about less than 1%. We now know under the clause that children with remediable conditions like cleft palate and club foot are being aborted in Britain. Children with Down syndrome as well, who have a low IQ. And the question, I think, for us as Christians is, do we make sacrifices for the weak in our community, or sacrifice the weak? Well, a godly community is one where the strong lay down their lives for the weak and make sacrifices for the weak, not sacrifice the weak for the sake of the strong. Another argument we get is this overpopulation thing, and this is what's driving the ideological colonization, if you like, it's been called, of the developing world, where international groups like IPPF and UNFPA are attempting to change the law in the countries in South America and Africa where abortion is still restricted. And a big thing driving this is this fear of overpopulation. But in actual fact, we know that if you provide good antenatal care, you empower women, you educate women, then they will voluntarily reduce the size of their families. That's what happened all over the Western world long, long before. So that should be our priorities, to provide good care and education and improve the lot of women, not to ignore that and help them to end the lives of their babies. This is an interesting graph, but I talked about demographic change. We'll probably come back to this a little bit when we talk about euthanasia later in the day. But these are demographic pyramids, and they show the number of people in every age group that there are. And the one on these are actually from Japan, where it's more marked than other countries, but every Western country follows this pattern. So you see in the left, in 1950 in Japan, 35% of the population were younger than 15, and only 4.9% were over 65. And that pyramid is pretty much what you see in most developing countries now. If you take the map for Nigeria, it'll look pretty much like that. The middle one, 2007, so just a few years ago, you see that the number in the working population has gone up 65%, 15 to 65-year-olds. But see how many more people there are, older people, 21%, and under 15s has fallen to 13%. What's going to happen in the future, 2015, 8.6% of the population younger than 15, 39, call it 40% greater than 65, and then only 51% are in the working population. Why do you think it is that Japan is leading the world in AI and robot technology? Because they're very worried about, there's so many old people and there's not enough young people and working people to look after them. And this is the demographic crisis that most of the West faces at the moment. And as we're going to come to later, the sad reality of it is that the generation which starts by killing its children will end up being killed by its children. And this is currently a Western trend which is effectively irreversible, and it is due partly to people reducing family size, but abortion is a huge contributor to this massive demographic change.